Now, section one of part three of the course, we have begun to deal with the defense or authentication of natural revelations, declaration of the existence, and I might add attributes of God. And the first and major passage we're dealing with is Romans 1:18-23. As we've already reminded ourselves this morning, its theme is that God's wrath is just against men, even men who don't have special revelation, because men, all men, are truth suppressors. And then we see the passage unfold itself in a very simple way. They are truth suppressors. Deity is used twice, because they have the truth, verse 19, because they suppress the truth, verse 21 and following. And that gave us our outline of the passage. A, as men have the truth, verses 19 and 20. B, as men suppress the truth, verses 21 through 23. We opened up those two points by looking, first of all, at the reality, author, duration, means, clarity, content, and result of their knowledge of God, and so showed that men, even by natural revelation, have a knowledge not only of God's eternal power, but also of His divine nature, that is to say, His other glories and attributes, His wisdom, goodness, and justice. And they know all of this from the posture of one who is the author of God. But then we've seen that they suppress the truth, and that verses 21 through 23 show us the progression in that downward spiral of suppression of truth. We saw its starting point, they knew God. We saw its sufficient cause. That cause was ethical in character and moral in character. There's a moral cause of their ignorance. We saw the instrumental means of their ignorance, which is their dialogismu, their rationalizations, their reasonings. We saw the exalted condition, their foolish heart was darkened. We saw their pompous claims within that darkened condition. And then we saw the monstrous extent of their ignorance in verse 23. Concluded by saying that the religions and philosophies of men outside of Jesus Christ, the natural theology or philosophy or religion they come up with as a result of the sensus deitatis and the semen religionis, is not their best approach to God, but the last height of their apostasy from God. And now that brings us to some apologetical observations in this lecture with regard to all of this. I'm going to open up these apologetical observations. I think there are 4 heads now. In previous editions of these notes, there have been 5 heads at this point. I rewrote this section considerably before last summer. So let's look at the apologetical observations with regard, first of all, to the knowledge of God. The knowledge of God. First of all, I want to say something about historical opinion. Classical apologetics states its estimate of the knowledge men have of God in different ways. Sometimes it asserts that man has the possibility of knowing God through the assistance of the theistic proofs, but has innately no real knowledge of God. At other times, it says that man has general notions of God, religion, and ethics, but has no specific or clear knowledge of God without the assistance of the theistic proofs. Aquinas tended sometimes to say that men knew or at least could know God, that God existed, but could not and did not know what He was like. He knew, to use Van Til's word, the that-ness of God, but not the what-ness of God. Kuyper, as we have seen, generally denied that there is remaining among natural men any knowledge of God. He taught that the natural principium, or source of such knowledge, had been distorted or blocked by human sin. So there's this wide range of opinion with regard to the knowledge of God among classical apologetics. But in the second place, we must then note the biblical distinction. Both the historical approaches to the knowledge of God mentioned above give a single answer to the question of whether men know God. Both fail, therefore, to understand or do justice to the crucial distinction or paradox which the Bible makes in answering this question. The question, do men know God, cannot be answered correctly with one word. You attempt to answer it with one word, you're going to be wrong no matter what you say. To answer this question, with either a yes or a no is wrong and superficial. When we ask the question, do men know God, to be fully biblical and balanced, we must answer yes and no, and in that order. As we have seen, Romans 1:18 to 23 teaches a key distinction with respect to apologetics and the knowledge which men have of God. It teaches, in the first place, that men know God, and the evidence for this assertion may be briefly reviewed. Verse 18 teaches that they suppress the truth. Verse 19 speaks of that which is known about God, and it goes on to say that it is evident in them. Verse 20 says it's understood, being clearly seen. Verse 21 describes them as those who knew God. Verse 30 describes them as haters of God. And verse 32 says they know the ordinance of God. It's very plain that they know God. So it teaches that men do know God, but it also teaches that men do not know God. And again, the evidence for this assertion may be briefly reviewed. Verse 21, we're told that their heart was darkened. Verse 23, we're told they exchanged truth for a lie. In verse 28, we learn that they did not see fit to have God in knowledge. Now, if we are to do justice to both these emphases of the passage, we must make a difference or distinguish between two kinds or two levels of knowledge. Various terms have been used by defenders of the faith to distinguish these two kinds of knowledge. I'm going to speak of constitutional and intellectual knowledge, and thus we must compare constitutional and intellectual knowledge of the natural man. Notice the footnote. Van Til uses different terminology to speak of this. He speaks of psychological knowledge of God, and that by that he's speaking of what I'm calling constitutional. He uses the term epistemological knowledge of God, and by that he's speaking of what I'm describing as intellectual. In other places, he speaks of a metaphysical knowledge of God, which men possess, and an ethical knowledge of God, which they do not possess by nature. Now, all of that is simply a terminological difference, and we may debate about what the best terminology is, but I intend to make no other or different distinction than what Van Til is making by the use of those terms. So, in terms of constitutional knowledge of God, notice the chart. We see from Romans 1 that natural men know God. But in terms of intellectual knowledge of God, we see that they're ignorant of God. And we need to compare these two things. With regard to the whole matter of reality, it's very plain from the Bible that it's a very real thing that both that men know God and that they're ignorant of God. They're equally real, I can put it that way. What's the relation of these two forms of knowledge of God, or of their knowledge of God and their ignorance of God in Romans 1? Well, for just trying to grapple with what Romans 1 is saying, when it speaks of their knowing God, it's talking about a revelatory impression made upon their constitutions. So for lack of better terminology, I'm going to speak of this knowledge as revelatory impression. When it says they're ignorant of God, however, it's speaking of their religions and their philosophies, and therefore I'm going to say that that has to do with an intellectual system. As to their condition, the constitutional knowledge of God is normally, I'm going to say, unconscious, although it is sometimes conscious. Even Caligula sometimes got recalled to God's tribunal, to use Calvin's illustration. Whereas their ignorance of God is their normal conscious condition. As to its effect, well, the knowledge of God, which they possess, is not an admitted working principle. It is the source of borrowed capital. Pratt speaks of that, page 32 and followings, when he says that sometimes men borrow capital from the bank of God's knowledge, but it's borrowed, or we might even say stolen, and fitted into a system in awkward kinds of ways. Whereas the intellectual ignorance of God they display is the normal working principle of their lives. It works with borrowed capital from man's constitutional knowledge. Then in terms of the duration, their constitutional knowledge of God is permanent. In terms of their ignorance of God, it's temporary. Now, that could be misunderstood. I never mean that they come to have a saving knowledge of God. I do mean to say the day comes when all their denials and all their refusals to acknowledge God will be burned away in the fires of hell. Christ is coming to convince all the ungodly of all their ungodly deeds which they have ungodly done. So that in that sense, this ignorance of God is going to be dissipated by the appearance of Jesus Christ. Now, Van Til and Reformed and Presuppositional Apologetics following him makes the crucial distinction of Romans 1:18-23 between man's constitutional knowledge of God and his ethical ignorance of God. Note the following diagram. So it says, on the ethical intellectual level, there is no true knowledge of the living God. But it says on the constitutional level, there is actual knowledge of the living God. And this is one of the great things that commends presuppositionalism, because so far as I know, Van Til and presuppositionalism were the primary people, if not the first, and if not the only people, to clearly make this paradoxical distinction between constitutional and intellectual knowledge, and assert plainly that they both know and do not know God. Now, classical apologetics is guilty of underestimating human depravity. By failing to make this distinction, it underestimates both the effects of man's depravity on his knowledge and the amount of light sinned against. Thus, it never indicts man severely enough for his sin. At any time it wishes to stress how much man knows about God, it must lessen human depravity. Because, you see, that it's depravity. They've given a single answer to this question. They haven't made the distinction. And so, they want to stress how much man knows. They've got to say he's not quite as sinful. They've got to think in a positive way about natural theology and about his reason. So anytime it wishes to stress how much man knows, it must lessen human depravity. Anytime it wishes to stress human depravity, it must lessen the clarity of divine revelation to men, because the more depraved they are, the less they know about God, according to classical apologetics. Human knowledge of God is like Italian dressing for salads, which is composed of two different liquids, vegetable oil and vinegar. By failing to make a difference between these two different things, we can never accurately describe Italian dressing. And if we don't make a distinction between constitutional knowledge of God and intellectual knowledge of God, we can never accurately describe men and their knowledge of God. If you try to describe Italian dressing as one thing, you'll never accurately describe it. You'll not do justice either by the oil or by the vinegar. In the same way, when it comes to the constitutional intellectual knowledge of God that men have, you'll never accurately describe it until you've made the distinction. Now, let me throw a mouthful of syllables at you. Classical apologetics has therefore normally been guilty of apologetical eutychianism. That's a opaque statement to make, isn't it? You know what eutychianism is? Eutyches, anybody remember anything about that from church history? Not exactly. Well, that could. Yeah. You know what? There's another name for eutychianism. That's right. Monophysitism. Derived from two Greek words, one meaning only. Phusis. No, not suke. Phusis. Nature. No, it's not suke. It's phusis. Monophusis. And we might say only or one naturism. The assertion of the Eutychians, later known as the Monophysites, was that Christ, after the incarnation, had only one nature. Now, the reaction of orthodoxy to that, you know, the proper doctrine is that Christ is both God and man in two distinct natures and one person forever. But these Monophysites felt that that went in the direction of another heresy, Nestorianism, and so they said that after Christ's incarnation, he possessed one nature. Now, the reaction of the Orthodox to that was to say that if that's true, then Christ, it results in either, you have to say, one of two false things. He has only one nature, well, three possibilities, really. But the one wouldn't have been done any justice to the Monophysite. If you're going to say that Christ has only one nature, what is it? You either have to say that it's the God nature, which denies that he has a human nature, and that's Docetism. You have to say he has a human nature and no God nature, and that's what? Well, that's Arianism or Ebionite heresy. Or you have to say what? He was a tertium quid, which means, the Latin means what? He was a third thing. He was neither God nor man. He was something else, which, of course, destroys his ability to do anything for our salvation, because he can do something for our salvation because he's both God and man. He's a third thing. He can't substitute for man, and he can't bring the divine nature to do anything for us. Now, do you see why I say that classical apologetics has been guilty of apologetical eutychianism? Because they've been guilty of one naturism. They've been guilty of saying man has one kind of knowledge of God. And you can never do justice to what man is until you admit that he has two different kinds of knowledge of God. And until you understand that, you'll never say anything right about man. You'll never do justice to his depravity, and you'll never do justice to his responsibility. You've got to say he knows God, and he doesn't know God. You have to say he doesn't know God to do justice to his depravity. You have to say he knows God to do justice to his responsibility. In fact, you have to say both to do justice to either, because if he doesn't know God, there can't be any depravity, because responsibility is the basis of depravity. You see, what I'm saying is that you have the same kind of problem. You have to embrace, in Christology, there had to come a point in church history where they embraced the paradox. He was both God and man. Not half of each, but both. And then in a classical apologetics, there was the same problem. There had to come a time when someone like Van Til would say, wait, men know God, they're fully responsible. They don't know God, they're really depraved. And until you made that distinction, you couldn't do justice to either one. So that's why I stress this as so crucially important. Go ahead.
And make a bridge between this important thing and presuppositional knowledge.
And presuppositional?
And presuppositional knowledge.
Well, I'm going to do that in a few minutes, Wilhelm, and rather than say anything that would be partial and imbalanced and get us there, I'm going to take up that whole thing in one of the points here. Okay? So, by failing to make a difference between these two different things, classical apologetics can never accurately describe either. Thus, it gives too positive a response to the wicked religions and philosophies of the natural man. Thus, also, it gives too vague, general, and low estimate of how much men actually know of the living God. Thus, it never severely enough accuses and charges the natural man with his sin. In other words, inevitably, it's going to give a weak understanding of natural man's sin, or at least logically, there's an inevitable tendency in that direction. Kuyper, on the other hand, you see, has attempted to do justice to how wicked and depraved even the minds and reasons of men are. He has seen clearly that the natural man has no right ethical or intellectual knowledge of God. He wants to stress that, without the key distinction of Scripture between intellectual knowledge of God and constitutional knowledge of God, he has concluded that in no sense do men know God. Without intending at all to do it, however, by saying that, he's removed the basis for the natural man's depravity. In attempting to stress his depravity and guilt, he has removed its very basis. Because unless a man is responsible, and he's responsible because Paul says in Romans 1, he knows God. Unless a man knows God, he can't be depraved or responsible. You see, in classical apologetics, once you say he knows God, then you're saying something positive about his natural theology. But then that minimizes its depravity. See, until you make the distinction between natural revelation and natural theology, you're caught on the horns of a dilemma. Stress how much men know, you decrease their depravity. Stress their depravity, you decrease how much they know. And thereby eliminate their depravity by removing its very basis. Another result of this failure to see clearly the distinction between these two kinds of knowledge and the reality of the natural man's constitutional knowledge of God was his conclusion that apologetics was basically useless. It was useless because they didn't have constitutional knowledge of God. There wasn't anything there to appeal to. You see, that was a result of Kuyper's failure to make this distinction. Now, that brings me in the second place, unless you have questions here, to the depravity of the fallen mind. Do you have any questions? All right, now let's look first of all under this heading at classical apologetics and human reason, what we might subtitle natural theology. Human reason is viewed by Roman Catholic theologians and classical apologists generally as at worst wounded. Now, that statement doesn't do justice completely to Princeton, but the fact is that Princeton has bought into a system of apologetics that was born and created in the semi-Pelagian atmosphere of Roman Catholicism. So they have a very real problem. So I'm not intending to say that Princeton didn't believe in total depravity. I am asserting that there was grave inconsistency at this point. Human reason is viewed by many Roman Catholic theologians and classical apologists as at worst wounded. By the way, that's not just true of Aquinas and Roman Catholicism, it's also true of Pinnock and Montgomery, neither of whom really believe in total depravity. Not viewed as dead in sins. Men are challenged on the basis of reason alone to construct for themselves a natural theology which will bridge the gap between themselves and the Christian faith. And to do that before they ever embrace Jesus Christ. They do it before they embrace Jesus Christ. They're doing it in the power of natural reason, uninformed by faith in Jesus Christ. That's the only alternative. Prior to accepting the gospel and believing in Christ, the classical apologist assumes that men may be convinced by theistic proofs of the existence and character of God. And thus a reason basically unaffected by the fall of man into sin has made the point of contact for Christian apologetics. Now, you see that in the charts that I give you on the next page. In a semi-Pelagian, and semi-Pelagian because influenced by Greek philosophy, you had the chain of being. The chain of being even applies to man internally. A man's reason is closest to God, his will is somehow in the balance, and his appetites, his fleshly appetites, are viewed as the seat of his depravity. So you see that there's a chain of being here. The more fleshly something becomes, the more it is against God. And so there's the whole chain of being influencing classical Roman Catholic apologetics, where the appetites are seen as the source of sin. Now, and reason is seen as basically at worst wounded, certainly not depraved in the sense of appetite. So apologetics appeals to and allies itself with human reason in that kind of system. Whereas the appetites tend downward to sin, reason tends upward to God, and so we appeal to it. And if we get a hold of the reason, then we can reorder the will and the appetites. Now, Reformed and Biblical apologetics assumes that man is totally depraved, including his reason. Now, of course, we still believe that we make our appeal to the minds of men. We make our appeal to the minds of men not because we don't believe. We believe it's less depraved because that's the natural order of things. Well, this is, of course, the teaching of Romans 1:18-23, where man is viewed as a truth suppressor who uses his reason to justify his wicked refusal to honor and thank God. You see, reason in Romans 1:18-23 is assumed to be depraved. It is under the influence of the ethical the heart of man that is ethically depraved and is used by that heart to justify its refusal to honor and thank God. Thus, Reformed apologetics, rather than making natural reason its ally, confronts human reason with divine standards. And so you see the next illustration, which teaches what the Bible teaches, that reason, will, and appetites all equally tend downward towards sin and away from God, and apologetics must therefore confront the whole man, including the sinful reason. Now, in light of this, Warfield's statement that Christianity makes its appeal to right reason, and that Christianity is valid for all normally working human minds, must be seen as naive and superficial. Such statements clearly underestimate the effect the sinfulness of human reason has on the apologetic problem. Basically, Warfield in those statements can state the issue in the exact same way as Roman Catholic classical apologetics did. Such statements clearly underestimate the effect the sinfulness of human reason has on the apologetic problem. Warfield attributes validity to sinful human reason's claim that it does not know God. He must attribute validity to it because he's a probabilist. If he's a probabilist, he has to be saying that the men really don't absolutely know God. And that means he's attributing a certain level of validity to that. No other way about it. He also assumes that you can deal with sinful human reason without challenging its presuppositions. That there's some sort of neutral ground you can begin with. Now, on the other hand, having looked at classical apologetics and human reason, we've got to look at Abraham Kuyper and total depravity, or what we might call natural revelation and common grace. Abraham Kuyper and those of his school put great stress on the total depravity of the human mind. To emphasize this, they have asserted that the natural man has lost all knowledge of God. Thus, when one asserts that in a sense men do know God despite their sin, those who have followed Kuyper's line of thought have accused them of denying total depravity. When presuppositionalists, Bentillians, have said to Kuyperians that men know God, the response of Kuyperians has been, well, by saying that, you must be denying the total depravity of the human mind. How can you say that men know God without denying total depravity? They have asked, aren't men totally depraved? Isn't then their knowledge of God depraved? Even their constitutional knowledge of God? Doesn't man's total depravity mean that they lose this knowledge? Now, to such questions I respond with an emphatic no. Why doesn't, however, total depravity mean that even mankind's constitutional knowledge of God is depraved or erased? Isn't total depravity total? Well, of course it's total. But several considerations will help us see the problem with Kuyper's thinking. First, man's constitutional knowledge is the presupposition of total depravity. Unless man knows God, he is not accountable to God, and he cannot sin against God. Now, that's clearly what Paul is implying in Romans 1. When he comes to ask the question, why is God just to reveal his wrath against men? What's he say? He says, it's just because they know God. So the knowledge of God is plainly viewed there as the presupposition of accountability and responsibility and therefore of depravity. Unless man knows God, he cannot sin against God. Where no law is, neither is there violation, to use Paul's words. Thus to say that depravity removes natural man's knowledge of God is to say that depravity, in effect, destroys itself. When it so depraves men that they cease to know God, then they cease to be sinners or depraved. Well, that's ridiculous, of course. That's why the Kuyperians can't be right in that sense. But secondly, man's constitutional knowledge is not subject to total depravity. It must be asked, has anyone ever here seen a totally depraved nose? Now, you've seen people whose noses looked totally depraved. But you know that no one has a totally depraved nose. You say, yeah, of course not. Noses aren't subject to total depravity. They're not that kind of thing. Right. And neither is the constitutional knowledge of God. It's the presupposition of depravity, but it is not subject to depravity any more than your nose is, although some of them look like it. So when it's so depraved, in the same way, constitutional knowledge may be suppressed, to use Paul's words, but it cannot be depraved. The third argument against the Kuyperians is this. Man's constitutional knowledge of God remains in hell. It remains in hell when he is not only totally, but even absolutely depraved. You see, sometimes, I don't know if you've seen this distinction, I think it's a valid distinction, properly explained. There's a distinction made between absolute depravity and total depravity. When we assert that men are totally depraved, we are not asserting that they're absolutely depraved. In other words, we're not asserting that they're as bad as demons. Obviously, the Bible makes plain that men can become worse than they already are, even as wicked sinners and unconverted men. They can get worse. That means that though they're totally depraved and they come forth from the womb totally depraved, that they're not yet absolutely depraved. They're not demons, all right? They haven't committed the unpardonable sin. We can go on to elaborate the distinction. So there's a distinction between total depravity and absolute depravity. But the fact is, when men get to hell, they're not only totally depraved, they're absolutely depraved. They are beyond hope. They're beyond pardon. They're cast forever into despair. But the fact is that even when men get to hell, they know God. They know God in hell. And yet they're absolutely depraved there. So you see, depravity doesn't remove people's constitutional knowledge of God. If depravity removed it, then the people who would know God least of all would be the people in hell. But that's, of course, nonsense. Fourthly, those who take Kuyper's position have recognized that some unconverted men do have some remnants of the knowledge of God. They recognize that because the Belgic Confession and the Canons of Dort say so, for one thing. But they have argued that the fact that men continue to know God constitutionally in their depravity is due to the restraint of common grace. They say, yes, we know that some of these unconverted men know God, but that's common grace. It's common grace that's allowed them to continue to know God. But that doesn't make any sense. Romans 1:18-23 teaches that the basis of human guilt before God and being exposed to the wrath of God is his constitutional knowledge of God through natural revelation. If such knowledge is due to common grace, this results in the very strange idea that it's common grace which is responsible for men going to hell for their sins. That's nonsense. Men may sin against common grace, no doubt, but common grace is not the root and basis of their responsibility before God. And that is a nonsensical conclusion. Bob?
Would it be correct in any way to say that common grace, that men's response to common grace, will magnify their responsibility to common grace?
Yeah, it certainly does magnify it. That's not the root of it, yeah. Clearly, many men have much more common grace than other men. And therefore say many more right things that are formally correct. See, it's something we have to remember here. When we are talking in this class about man, we're talking about the natural man who has no access to special revelation. That's the man in his natural fallen condition. And that gives us a very absolute contrast between those who know God and those who don't. Now, when you begin to bring in the whole orbit of special revelation, what men are like in that orbit, then you have all sorts of other problems and complications that come in. It's plain that special revelation, when it comes to bear upon men, exercises among many of them a restraining, a common grace kind of effect. And that common grace results in the fact that you have very morally restrained people who, in terms of their lips, give a very orthodox treatment account of who God is. Now, how do we account for that if they're unconverted? Well, we account for it by the fact of common grace. And if men in the orbit of special race revelation refuse common grace, they reject it, then what? Well, then that increases their guilt. But it's not the root and basis of it. Fifthly, the true view of the relation of total depravity to natural revelation is this. Total depravity uniformly influences man's response to natural revelation and the knowledge or awareness of God it imparts. It is in this sense that it's total or uniform. Men never respond aright to natural revelation in the sense of being influenced in a positive ethical direction by it. That is, they say they are not prepared for salvation or saved by it, even if that were possible. It is in that sense that it's total or uniform. There comes, therefore, from natural men in their depravity, no positive, proper, natural theology. But the natural revelation gets through. That's what we're saying. So total depravity uniformly influences man's response to natural revelation and the knowledge or awareness of God it imparts. It is in that sense that it is totally uniform. Yet it does not erase that revelation from his consciousness, nor does it deliver him from being continually confronted by it. Depravity doesn't deliver men from being confronted by revelation. Obviously not. As I've said five times already, that would mean to eliminate and destroy depravity itself. Any questions? Yes, Earl?
In regards to what people say about the truth and how will they need to be saved or not, as you say, if the gospel isn't preached to them,
yes.
And what they see, well, this is a religion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. Men are depraved. They're responsible to God by natural revelation, but they are not saved by it, because natural revelation is never. Well, there are a lot of other things we're going to go on to say. Natural revelation is never the means God uses to save people. It can't be the means God uses to save people. It's never presented that way in the Bible. I hope in reading through the notes on the two kinds of revelation, you saw very plainly the glaring, the deafening silence of Psalm 19 and Romans 1 with regard to any saving or beneficial effect of natural revelation. That silence is deafening. It's more than just silence, as we're going to see in our exposition of Romans 2. Yes, Paul? Yes. Presupposition of depravity. It's not subject itself to depravity. When we're talking about depravity, we're talking about something ethical. Constitutional knowledge of God is pre-ethical. It's the basis for an ethical sphere of life, but it's not something that is subject to depravity or alteration by sin. It's a given of God in man's constitution. And that's why the illustration of the nose is, yes, noses are physical. What we're talking about is metaphysical, fine. But still, it's the same kind of issue. When we assert total depravity, we do not assert that the human body is totally depraved. Well, isn't that part of man? Isn't the body part of man? If he's totally depraved, isn't his body depraved? No, because bodies are not ethical in the strict sense of that word. In the same way, constitutional knowledge of God, well, it's pre-ethical, it forms the basis for ethical behavior. It's not itself an ethical, a dispositional kind of thing. Yes, Mike? Yes and no. The reason, depends how you define reason. There's a sense in which that's true, and there's a sense in which I think you have to make the same kind of distinction with regard to reason as you do with regard to knowledge. In Romans 1, it's plain that the term for reason speculations, dialogismu, that's used there, is ethical. It is something that stands logically subsequent to the depravity of the human heart and is subject to the depraving influences of the human heart. So I would acknowledge that in a certain sense, a reason defined in a certain way could be pre-ethical in the same way we're talking about it, the fundamental capacities of the human mind. However, I think the same kind of distinction needs to be made there. And in Romans 1, the word that describes the systematic thinking, the intellectual systems of men, is clearly ethical in character. Now, you might say, well, when he says they knew God, isn't that rational? Yes, it is rational. So there's a distinction even with regard to reason. Reason is not, therefore, any more than knowledge of God, something that's one and single. It's a complex of things. The basis for reason and for man's intellectual systematic kind of thinking is laid in this constitution, but it never comes to any expression but that which is depraved, according to the Apostle Paul in nature. Other questions? Yes, Mike?
You wouldn't vote on them for 5 years. You would feel very tight. And so both have an element of reason that we appeal to a reason that is being suppressed or being faulty after the suppression, yet also there's nothing wrong with the mental faculty, so that the mind is able to reason well. And that's why you've got the best exemplary argument to a reason that does
That's one of the reasons why it's so difficult to grapple with what Warfield is saying, because there is an element of truth in what he's saying. I think that's why I described what he's saying as naive and superficial, because he gives too low estimate, too simplistic an estimate of all the complicated ways that sin affects the way people think. And it's guilty of this very thing we're talking about. It looks at reason only as constitutional and not as ethical, whereas the Bible presents it as both and makes it very plain that anything that we might call natural theology, anything that's the result of man's intellectual systematic bent, is going to be depraved. And so I think there's a guilty of a one-sidedness about statements like that. Okay? That's why he can so easily buy into Roman Catholic terminology and classical terminology, because of that very one-sidedness in his thinking. Or imbalance, I think I'd like to say better, rather than one-sidedness. Okay, let's go on to the philosophy of the natural man. First of all, the historical problem. Throughout the history of Christian apologetics, again, why we had to do that. We noticed again and again the attempt of well-meaning Christian teachers to use popular views and philosophies of their period in the Christian faith. Justin Martyr adapted Platonism to this purpose. We argued that the result of this was disastrous for Christian truth, despite its supposed advantages. Thomas Aquinas utilized Aristotelian philosophy and logic to construct his massive statement of Christian doctrine and truth. We noticed how this made his arguments for God almost impossible to understand. We also noticed how it exposed those arguments to many objections. On the other hand, men like Tertullian in the early church and Kuyper in the modern period emphasized the antithesis. That's a key word, by the way, in Kuyperian theology, antithesis. Or the complete hostility or contradiction between Christian faith and worldly philosophy. This, however, has made it difficult for them to explain the measure of truth, goodness, and progress that worldly societies have manifested. They've had a more difficult time than Justin Martyr explaining the degree of value present in non-Christian religions and philosophies. That's the historical problem. Might be the biblical solution. Again, Romans 1, 18 to 23 gives us a beginning in properly resolving this problem. the religious tendency in men is due to the innate sense of deity, which natural revelation develops in them. By implication, the philosophical tendency in men, which makes them seek after ultimate truth, is due to the same reality. I'm saying philosophy is not, for our purposes, distinct from religion. Religion is a search for ultimate meaning in reality. So also is philosophy. So anything that Paul says about false religions and natural men has to be said about their philosophies as well. The philosophies and religions of natural men all work with this innate sense of deity and seed of religion planted in them by their creator. Fundamentally, they are perversions and distortions of this natural revelation. Their suppression of the truth operates by substituting false gods for the true one, and lies for the truth. The appearance of truth and value in their intellectual systems is due to the dim reflections of truth we occasionally glimpse through the air which covers it. Now, according to their natural tendency, such systems could manifest no practical value or outward goodness. The false starting points of these religions and philosophies could have no value or goodness in God's world. Another reality must be taken into account. God, in his common grace, restrains the sins of men. He introduces blessed inconsistencies into their thinking. It is such inconsistencies with religions and philosophies to manifest a measure of value and goodness. This reality of common grace is not clear, nor is it emphasized in Romans 1:18-23. Yet, the emphasis of Paul on the fact that natural men should give thanks to God, and that the goodness of God leads natural men to repentance, Romans 2:4, Acts 14:17, makes plain that God has not abandoned or ceased to work with wicked natural men. Fundamentally, however, the teaching of Romans 1:18-23 is that all the philosophies and religions of natural men have their foundation in a rejection of their duty to honor God and thank Him. They all operate, in other words, with the presupposition that they have no obligation to honor or thank the living God. Naturally, intellectual systems growing out of such a premise or presupposition will, without exception, eventually poison any defense of the Christian faith which attempts to use them. Despite their appearance of truth, goodness, and beauty, they are simply sophisticated disguises for the worm of sin. Thus, we must not follow Justin Martyr or Thomas Aquinas in their use of Plato or Aristotle to defend the Christian faith. Such defenses of the Christian faith either result in the perversion of the faith or end up proving nothing. All right, any questions there? Yes, go ahead.
What about Aristotle?
I don't think Aristotle originated the syllogism. Aristotle certainly did say a lot of right things about syllogism, but that's not equivalent, in my thinking, to Aristotelian philosophy or logic. There's no question about the fact that in common grace, God allowed Aristotle to say many good things about syllogism, but he isn't Aristotle didn't originate the concept of the syllogism. That's the way I would respond to that. Is that the question? Okay. Now we come to, I think, the question you raised, Wilhelm, will come up here. And if you have questions after we talk, please feel free to ask them. This is the problem of the contact point or common ground. Anytime, as we have seen, that you engage in apologetics, giving a reason for the hope that is in you, 1 Peter 3:15, we saw that there is an assumption of common ground. When you give that reason, you cannot do so without making certain assumptions about common ground. That's why you cannot avoid the connection between apologetics and the whole subject of contact point or common ground. They're inseparably related. The above discussion of non-Christian religion and philosophy naturally raises the question or problem of common ground or the point of contact between believer and unbeliever. Classical apologetics has made natural reason and its better productions the point of contact between the Christian faith and the natural man. Kuyper and his school have pointed out the depravity of natural reason and the need to set presupposition against presupposition. As a result of this, they, for all practical purposes, deny that there is any point of contact between believer and unbeliever and concluded the uselessness of apologetics, at least tended to. All right, that still isn't quite fair by Kuyper, but it is generally, in a simplistic way, the tendency of his thought. Our study of 1 Peter 3:15 led us to conclude that there is a point of contact between the saved and the unsaved. Peter himself assumed this when he told his Christian readers to make a defense of the hope within them to any who should ask. 1 Peter 3:15, however, does not make plain what that point of contact may be. Since the Bible teaches the depravity and wickedness of natural reason, the question cannot be answered in the way classical apologetics has done. Romans 1:18-23 enables us to answer the question of common ground as following. First of all, we have to say that Paul teaches that the believer and unbeliever have nothing in common. Romans 1:18-23 teaches, first of all, that believers and unbelievers have nothing in common. That is to say, they have nothing in common with the religions or philosophies growing out of the bitter root of man's refusal to honor and thank the living God. False religions are not approaches to Christianity. They are degenerate. They are not, in any sense, an approach to the regenerate religion. There is no common ground between the way of life and thinking which honors and thanks God and the way which does not. There is no point of contact between light and darkness, and their foolish heart was darkened. As to man's intellectual knowledge, he is ignorant of God. Therefore, our appeal must not be to man's intellectual interpretations of reality, what he admits to be so, his religions and his philosophy. He must remember that the unbeliever's presuppositions are false. His presupposition, fundamentally, according to Romans 1, is he does not honor and have to honor and thank God. That's a false presupposition. We must therefore, and this false presupposition makes his entire interpretation of reality completely false. We must therefore never permit him, on the basis of his philosophies or religions, to decide whether Christianity is true. We must never appeal to him to consider the truth of Christianity on his own grounds, from his own presuppositions. There is need for repentance, regeneration, and revolution in the unbeliever, not merely the revision of his view of the world. And so that's the first thing we have to say. Unbeliever and believer. Intellectually and strictly have nothing in common. But in another sense, we have everything in common. Everything in common. Yes, Bob? In common. In another sense, this key passage of God's Word teaches us that the believer and unbeliever have everything in common. How does this key distinction show this? Well, first of all, Romans 1:18-23 assures us that we have a point of contact with the remnant of the gospel. Man not only has a vague sense of deity, he knows the true God. He knows him. Not just that some God exists. He knows the God of eternal power, wisdom, justice, and goodness. He knows that God. He knows him as the offspring of God with a sense of his own guilt. So man not only has a vague sense of deity, he knows the true God. He does not merely have the capacity by means of complex theistic proofs to be brought to this knowledge of God. He is confronted with the existence of God continually. This knowledge and confrontation with the true God is far-reaching. He knows the power, goodness, justice of God. He knows the wrath of God. He is aware that as an apostate son of God, he is exposed to that wrath. God and the gospel are relevant for the worst pagans, and they always make sense. They always make sense to the sinner. They always fit his condition. But now, having said that, we come to say, therefore, that there is the inevitability of confrontation. The inevitability of confrontation. Romans 1:18 to 23 teaches that man's intellectual problems with the gospel are ultimately moral and ethical in their causes. Ignorance and anti-Christian intellectual systems are the product of sin. The fact that men know God and that their true problem is moral has a deep impact, must have a deep impact on our method of presenting the gospel. First of all, it teaches us that there is no avoiding confrontation. Confrontation is necessary. We must set before men the absolute difference between what we believe and what they believe. We must emphasize the antithesis, that is to say, the intellectual hostility between Christianity and every other view. People today like to think of themselves, and I'm saying this because what I just said is altogether more important today. People today like to think of themselves as tolerant and accepting. They'll attempt to put a construction on our teaching which they can't accept for their viewpoint. You talk to them, they're going to try to find a way to agree with you. They're not going to be confrontational. They're going to be trying to be very tolerant. They're going to try to find a way that they can say, oh, I agree with you, yeah. We can't let them do that because they don't really agree with us. We must constantly make plain the absolute differences between what they believe fundamentally and what we believe. Secondly, all this means that our manner, while kind, must be one of authoritative boldness. Because men do know God, anything short of a demand that they accept the truth is wrong. Anything else betrays the truth. We must never so present the truth of the gospel as to imply that there is any possibility that it might not be true. We must always present the gospel as absolute truth accompanied by undoubtable evidence. 3. Romans 1:18 to 23 makes clear that the explanation for the natural man's intellectual problems with the gospel is always, at bottom, moral. If we are really to address his needs, our presentation of the gospel, and even clearly, this being his problem, the unconverted man will always feel personally attacked by the gospel. It's unavoidable. Unless God gives him repentance. Unless he repents, what it says about him must make him angry. As those commanded to preach the gospel, we must never think we can avoid this uncomfortable situation. We must never try to invent a gospel or method of presenting it which avoids this. If we succeed in inventing such a gospel or such a method, it will only be by betraying and destroying the biblical gospel. There's no way to sneak up on an unconverted man ultimately. Ultimately, the demand has to be for repentance. And either he accepts that or he gets angry. But then that brings us, having seen that the fact that we have everything and nothing in common, and seeing the inevitability of confrontation, to the necessity of presuppositionalism in theistic proofs. The necessity of presuppositionalism. I deduce this from the whole, everything we've said about common ground. As we have seen, Romans 1:18, the distinction with regard to the natural man's knowledge of God. Constitutionally knows God, cannot help but know God, intellectually does not know God, and his foolish heart is darkened. This means, when we raise the question of common ground, that the unbeliever and believer have everything in common and nothing in common. Both of these responses to the question of common ground are of great importance with regard to the subject of theistic proofs. Because the unbeliever has everything in common with the believer, including the fact that both know of the existence of God, in a sense, the theistic proofs are not necessary. They are not necessary because we do not need to prove to the unbeliever what he already knows. The theistic proofs, as put together in classical apologetics, were intended to bring the natural man from a state of not knowing God to a state of knowing God. Or, They were intended to bring him from a state of knowing God vaguely and uncertainly to a state of knowing God clearly and certainly. Theistic proofs put together for such purposes are unnecessary. The unbeliever already knows God and knows him so clearly and certainly that he is without excuse. Because the unbeliever, on the other hand, has nothing in common with the believer, the theistic proofs of classical apologetics are also misguided. The theistic proofs have been built on what was thought to be neutral ground. Justin Martyr took the supposedly neutral ground of Plato's philosophy. Aquinas took the neutral ground of Aristotle's logic in philosophy. In both cases, the theistic proofs assumed that there was an intellectual neutral ground between believer and unbeliever. According to Romans 1:18-23, no such neutral ground exists. We might have thought that in the religious desires and thoughts of the unbeliever, there would be some ground that was not stained by a sin. Yet Paul sees the religion of the natural man as the high point and climax of his depravity. Theistic proofs, which assume that the unbeliever does not know God, and which assume that there's an intellectually neutral ground, are not biblical, useful, sound, or convincing. This does not mean that the theistic proofs are wrong. They simply must be properly put together. Romans 1:18-23 asserts that the world proves the existence of God every moment of its existence. Psalm 19:1-2 as well. For theistic proofs to be valid or sound, however, they must be presuppositional in character, and this means two things. First, this means that they must presuppose or assume that men already know that God exists. We don't construct them assuming that, then they're built on a lie. Theistic proofs must have for their focus leaving men without excuse by exposing their suppression of the truth. That's their aim. Second, this means that theistic proofs must presuppose or assume that there is no such thing as neutral ground intellectually. All intellectual systems and religious ideas are either built on a humble and thankful acknowledgement of the living God or a refusal to honor and thank God. It is impossible to prove the existence of the living God on the basis of a system which begins by thinking that we need not honor or thank God. You'll never get to the one from the other. The presupposition of such a system makes it impossible. If they are to be right and sound, the theistic proofs must be radically altered away from what they were in classical apologetics. They must assume that men already know God and expose their suppression of the truth. They must realize that there is no neutral ground and self-consciously assume the existence of the living God. Now, as I've lectured on this and thought about some of the questions we've been talking about, there's probably one further thing that needs to be said, and again has to do with common grace. And because the reality of natural revelation, allowing men, and sometimes, I think, to borrow capital from their knowledge of God, natural men do say things that, isolated from their system, are formally correct. We may appeal to those things in themselves as within the context of presuppositional proofs for the existence of God. What Paul does in Acts 17, reading back to men what their altars to unknown gods mean, reading back to men what their statements about God, that God being the one in whom we live and move and have our being, God, our being the offspring of God, what those statements really and properly mean. So there is common grace as a reality that I think has to be dealt with at this point here. At least I think it's common grace that I want to talk about. At any rate, we need to deal with the fact that every unbeliever's system, if it, insofar as it works in the real world, works because it's inconsistent. Insofar as it embraces anything in the world, embraces it by being inconsistent with this ground presupposition, or this ethical presupposition. All right, so I wanted to say that because I could foresee questions and also because I think that is a reality that you have to think about in terms of presuppositionalism and the theistic proofs and how we speak with unbelievers. The whole issue of the fact that they assume things within their systems which they have no intention of us to understand the way we will understand it and read to them the way we do read it to them, but that actually do have that meaning, like the right of privacy and other things we talked about the other night. Questions? Wilhelm, is that beginning to address some of the questions that you were raising? Yeah. Yes, Mike? That's a key point, that they, that the inconsistencies have two values. The inconsistencies are inconsistent with their own presupposition. They don't, the things they say can't be, don't have any place logically and strictly in the system built on the presuppositions that they have. But they do have a place, and they do fit in the Christian system. And so there's the, there's what some people have called the transcendental argument, negatively used. Look, you say things that you can't justify, but what you can't justify, but you have to say, and you do apparently believe, is consistent with the Christian presentation of truth. The unbeliever assumes the existence of moral right and wrong. But in a system where there's no living God, there's no way to justify that assumption. There is only a, there is a way to justify it within the Christian system. The unbeliever assumes, well, many, many other things. He assumes the personal nature of humanity. There is such a thing as personality. There is such a thing as personal reality, responsible personal being. But he has no way of explaining that within the boundaries of his own presuppositions and system. Christians have a way of explaining that. It's on and on you go. Every time the unbeliever says something, he almost inevitably has to. He's dealing with God's world, and these things in God's world have certain meanings. He has to say them, but they don't fit in the system. That's the point I want to hammer home when we come later on to illustrate this in more length. Okay? Okay, let's go ahead. Okay.